Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media and WBFO, this is What's Next Producers Picks, highlights of conversations heard on previous episodes. On today's show.
So yeah, that's kind of how it comes into fruition in Buffalo, and in that it's kind of the moment where as a city, we shift a little bit more to becoming more supportive of women's suffrage.
Buffalo's first female historian, Lindsay Lauren Visser. And we close with
not having access to food, not having access to water, having housing insecurity, housing instability, just poverty, right? Systemic and generational poverty. Right.
Licensed master social worker, Chaney Brockington. I'm Thomas O'Neill White. First, we revisit my conversation with Buffalo's first female historian, Lindsay Lauren Visser. We discuss the anniversary of the 19th Amendment, which gave women the right to vote, and the significant role Buffalo played in the suffragist movement. So, let's talk about the early suffrage movement. Seneca Falls Women's Rights Convention in 1848.
Yes. And if you haven't been, it's such an easy day trip from Buffalo. I've actually spent a lot of time in Seneca Falls, and it's been absolutely wonderful. But that really is the seminal moment when we talk about the birth of the women's rights movement, the women's suffrage movement. And it stems from a lot of women who are frustrated from being disenfranchised and also reaching out to other communities that have been typically overlooked. And so with Seneca Falls, what we see is actually a beautiful combination of African-American attendants and women and people from across the region. And they come together to create this declaration of sentiments that really speaks to their frustrations and their goals. And that does open the door to the women's suffrage movement. And it disseminates from Seneca Falls, but it takes some time to really take root in a substantive way. And we see that especially in Buffalo and other places, because while now in our modern sensibility, we would say this is a wonderful thing, mm-hmm. Women having the right to vote. Why wouldn't you jump on that right away? Well, there were a lot of societal issues that would have made it very difficult or very dangerous to support women's suffrage, especially during this early period. There would have been a lot of instances of women being accused of being unfit or insane and even institutionalized for having radical beliefs. There are very few protections for women at this point as mothers, and it would have been very easy for their husbands to take their children away from them. So to devote your life to this radical cause at this early phase of the women's suffrage movement would have been very difficult and very dangerous. So we see especially, I think, in this time period, it not really taking root in Buffalo, but you see a handful of individuals who have access to these ideas very early on and carry that with them in their later career.
Now, if I was a successful businessman at that time with my wife who was a suffragist, could my business be affected if not only my wife was speaking out on these issues, but I was also, you know, full-throated endorsing what she was saying.
Oh, for sure. Reputation's everything during this time frame. I mean, it still is in many respects, but I think to put your neck out there for something like this, you did really open yourself up to criticism and people scoffing at you, making fun of you, avoiding your business, or even kind of being dismissive of you or making horrible comments about your wife. It's so unfortunate, but at the same time, I think when we look at, you know, even the course of history in general, when new ideas emerge that are, you know, immediately embraced, there is a lot of backlash. Mm-hmm. It is very controversial. We still try to navigate these things, and we see often the worst side of humanity coming out in reaction to these new ideas. And that was absolutely the case with women's suffrage.
So you mentioned the movement doesn't really gain a lot of traction in Buffalo at first, but something changes.
It does. But I do want to say Belva Lockwood actually is one of the individuals who ends up coming into contact with Susan B. Anthony, because Belva Lockwood's a teacher and she's actually running a girls' school and ends up kind of becoming immersed in these suffrage ideas. And she really does carry that with her. And so she kind of becomes, in that early suffrage movement time period, one of, I think, the most influential and impactful women, even at a national level. And she's from here, of course. but what I love about Belva is she felt that the law was the answer to these kinds of issues and the lack of opportunity women faced. So she wanted to become a lawyer, which as a woman was a very difficult thing. She ended up going to DC and finding a law school that would take her. And the school actually that she attends becomes, I believe, a precursor to George Washington University School of Law. And she goes through, she completes her degree, ends up getting to graduation. They refuse to give her and the other female students their diplomas.
Wow.
Yeah. And so she actually petitions the president of the United States to intervene. And to everyone's great surprise, he does and basically says these students have completed their required education. They should get their diploma. So that at least allowed her to then try to gain admittance to the bar. But she quickly found that as a woman, she wasn't eligible to try cases in federal courts because the bar didn't allow women to do so. So God bless her. She drafted legislation and personally lobbied Congress to get the law passed to allow her and other female lawyers to practice in federal court. So she becomes the first woman admitted to the Supreme Court bar, becomes the first woman to try a case before the Supreme Court. So this is huge and monumental in its own right. Absolutely cemented her place in the annals of history. But she doesn't stop. She also ensures that there's space for all voices in federal courts. And so she personally sponsors one of the first African-Americans admitted to the bar. And he goes on to try the first case that an African-American tries before the Supreme Court. And in 1884, she decides she's going to run for president, which is just incredible when you think of the fact that women can't vote. She couldn't vote for herself. And because Buffalo is just at the heart of everything, 1884, she's running against the former mayor of Buffalo, Grover Cleveland, who ends up being successful in that election. But she's on the ballot, she gets votes, and she's, I think, one of the really significant early pioneers of women's suffrage. And she does make women's suffrage an issue that she talks about quite a bit.
From my admittedly little bit of research, there were at this time different suffrage movements, an anti-suffrage movement, a competing suffrage movement in the state of Massachusetts. So a lot of moving parts in the mid to late 19th century.
Yeah. Anti-suffrage really did become a movement in its own right. And it had a lot of very prominent voices, especially at the local level. And women that you might think, really? You're anti-suffrage? Most notably, Mariah Love, who is the founder of our nation's first daycare, big supporter of working women who really wanted to improve their lives, very philanthropic, very influential in the community, was anti-suffrage. She felt that women already had too many burdens, that the vote was just another expectation that was going to be placed on them, and didn't think that it was productive in terms of addressing the issues that women faced. And that was a very common thread. There were, again, a lot of women who felt that they had more power outside of the ballot box in terms of influencing the course of events by just having conversations with the people in power or really going about solving the social ills through philanthropic work. And so for Mariah Love, she, in some respects, and to her point, was able to do more for working women outside of having the vote than she would have been able to with her vote.
Now, that brings me to the question, how common was it for these women to speak to these, obviously, men in power? I mean, is it how would you compare it to like these days? I mean, I guess
Well, I can get walk up to Chuck Schumer and ask him about something.
Yeah, but I suppose it's probably easier now. But part of it, too, is you do have a slightly different culture at the time. But a lot of the women who have the time to be either pro or anti-suffrage are in that position because they have the time and the financial security to do so. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the time we are talking about wealthier white women because that was a group that could afford to be involved in these issues either for or against. So when we think of it that way, having access amongst that group to influential individuals would be fairly common. This is also a time period where social clubs are thriving. The 20th Century Club, the women's club, the social club, the Buffalo Club. So it would have been fairly common to be able to be in a social atmosphere where, say, maybe not Chuck Schumer, but, you know, the mayor of Buffalo's wife is at the 20th Century Club, right, and you can chat with her and then she can go home and tell her husband what she heard. And there is a little bit of politicking behind the scenes. So there are certainly women who feel like this is sufficient. We don't need the vote. It's not going to yield the same results as a well-placed conversation is going to. Or so there is some disagreement in even, I think, within the suffrage community of, you know, what are the necessary steps in order to be able to actualize ourselves in our democracy.
We get to 1878, women's suffrage amendment introduced in U.S. Mm-hmm. Congress, and then we move over to the middle of the movement.
Yeah.
1901, Pan-American Exposition Board of Women Managers, right here mm-hmm. in the city of Buffalo.
Yes.
Talk about it.
Well, again, drawing from, I think, that tradition really of the 20th Century Club, you do have a lot of very influential women who want a voice in one of the biggest events in Buffalo's history. And so they do take a very active role. And you do start to see women being more active and more engaged. But Mary Talbert, I think, is a great example of somebody during that time period who was incredibly involved in the Pan-American Exposition and really was sitting between two worlds as a woman of color, in that she was actively campaigning for the advancement of African Americans, but then also actively campaigning for women's suffrage. And so, especially in that like transitional time, we start to see women dabbling a little bit more with getting out into society and really pushing for these things in Buffalo. And when we look across the country, too, World War One really does start to shift things for women's suffrage in a more obvious way, because women start occupying a different role in society. When the men go off to fight and they're working in factories, they're taking on more responsibilities. Their sons are being sent to war.
Mm-hmm.
Now, all of a sudden, women are recognizing that they are functioning in society in a more meaningful way, and they're not given the opportunity to make decisions about the direction society is going in. And so it becomes a more glaring juxtaposition between what they're currently doing and what they're currently being denied. And that does help cement the suffrage movement and accelerate and augment it in a much more pronounced way.
So who leads this demonstration in the city of Buffalo?
That's actually a really good question. I believe it is the Erie County suffragist group that ends up leading it. And in fact, when we talk about the Buffalo of Six, which we'll probably do in a second here, one of those suffragettes, Ada Kendall, was the president of the women's suffrage group in Erie County. And that actually does predate that 1914 movement and the demonstration that they had in City Hall. So we did have some groups that were in existence. The National Women's Party had a chapter in Buffalo. There are a lot of organizations that are starting to mobilize. And so you do see more unity amongst mm-hmm. these groups, again, because of all those issues, as I talked about with the war and just the augmenting of suffrage. So that's kind of how it comes into fruition in Buffalo, in that it's kind of the moment where, as a city, we shift a little bit more to becoming more supportive of women's suffrage.
1917, New York becomes the first East Coast state to enfranchise women. And then, obviously, August of 1920, 19th Amendment becomes the law of the land. You mentioned the Buffalo Six, but let's dig into it. Who were these women and what was their part in the suffrage movement?
Yeah, I think, as I mentioned before, that window of time from like 1914 to 1919, when we really start moving things along, is so iconic for, I think, what we think of as women's suffrage. When if you were to think in your head of an image of a suffragette, you're probably thinking of a woman in white with her purple and yellow sash, and she's holding a sign in front of the White House, right? That is this moment. That is the iconic shift in women's suffrage. And six women from Buffalo were actively a part of that and did jail time as a result of their involvement. So, in an effort to really turn the pressure on, Alice Paul, who is one of the national women's suffrage leaders, encourages the picketing of the White House in an effort to really put this issue front and center for Woodrow Wilson. The only party, if memory serves, the only party that really had managed to make women's suffrage a plank in its platform was the Progressive Party, which was run by Theodore Roosevelt back in 1912 as his ploy to try to, you know, win the presidency away from his Republican challenger, William Howard Taft. And the combination of those two is what makes Woodrow Wilson president. So really, this is just kind of so new. He's like, what the heck is going on here? So Alice Paul really encourages these women to be what she calls silent sentinels, which are peaceful protests of the White House. Some of the campaign signs are a little racy for 1917, right? They're like, how long must women wait when you send our sons to war? And like really provocative, pointed criticisms. And at one point, Wilson is just like, this can't go on. And so he has them arrested because it's complicated, right? You can't arrest them for picketing. It's First Amendment protected. Yes. So he has them arrested for the obstruction of traffic, which seems absurd, but works. So they get rounded up. And so this happens throughout 1917. And in fact, one of the women from Buffalo, Janet Frothingham, is in one of the first groups to actually be imprisoned for this. And so what happens is they're picketing the White House, they're arrested, they're put in front of a judge. The judge says, okay, you need to pay a fine, right? And again, as I mentioned, these are women who can afford to pay the fine. Mm-hmm. They refuse. And so they're sent to Occoquan Workhouse in Virginia. This is the first time that women of this social class are being sent to a workhouse. And so when their relatives catch wind of this, they're horrified, and especially with how these women are being treated. And so the first wave that Janet is a part of, she ends up being pardoned very quickly afterward because it kind of becomes a bit of a scandal, right? Woodrow Wilson, you can't have put these women in workhouses, right? This is insane. So he pardons them after 3 days, and they refuse to leave. They're like, we don't want the pardon. We want the vote. And so this kind of gives rise to, in some respects, the badge of honor, right, of being arrested and sent to Occoquan Workhouse. So you do see women from across the country, including Buffalo, who pick up and they go to Washington specifically to picket the White House. And so you have people like Amy Yingling, who's a teacher from Black Rock. She goes down with her aunt, who actually it's her aunt who really wants to picket the White House. And and her aunt's too old. And they're like, well, you can't, but you can. And so Amy, who's like, I thought I was just here to stuff envelopes, is like, okay, I guess I'm picketing the White House today. So she ends up in prison. And Hattie Krueger, who is a nurse from the area, also goes down. The two of them are part of the group of 14 women that I think I mentioned earlier who were subjected to the Night of Terror, which was really is traumatic event in which by November of 1917, the women in Occoquan were becoming increasingly what the guards would have considered unruly. And the reason behind this was they were hunger striking. They were protesting the fact that they were not being held as political prisoners. They were protesting the conditions that they were being held in. And it culminated in this night of abuse toward the women where they were beaten and they were force-fed and all of these horrible things happened. And Hattie Kruger actually ends up testifying in court with two of the other suffragists about her experience. And the judge at that point declines to look into it any further. But this was, again, starting to change the public perception of the treatment of these women. Mm-hmm. They're peacefully protesting, right? So in addition to the ones that I mentioned, you also have Janet Frothingham's sister, Margaret, who's a teacher at Buffalo Public School 42. She goes down. And I actually love the newspapers from this time because it does kind of give you a little bit of a glimmer into what people are thinking. One of the other ones, Edith Eng, I love her. Her rap sheet is amazing. She's accused of starting a suffrage riot at an event one time. So she goes to an anti-suffrage convention and basically screams at the senator who was anti-suffrage, and a riot ensues. And so she's arrested for that. Over the course of her life, she pickets the White House. She's one of the first women to do the Watch Fires of Freedom, which was another tactic as things were starting to progress more in 1919, where the women would burn speeches from Woodrow Wilson in front of the White House, in like a perpetual keeping the fires going, like they would watch them. So they call them the Watch Fires. And so she was arrested for everything. She did jail time 5 different occasions throughout her stint with suffrage. So she really is, I think, one of, to my mind, the more aggressive suffragists. But
the real rabble rouser.
She really was. And when you see her picture too, even later in life, she's a little older woman and she's holding her New York flag, and you could just see the iron resolve in her face. She's just awesome. And then there's Ada Kendall. And Ada is one of the first journalists really working. Her mother was actually a journalist too, but she's one of the first to be working for one of the major newspapers in Buffalo. She ends up being the leader of the Erie County suffragists, and she also went down to Washington to picket. She did 30 days in Occoquan and actually ended up doing 6 days in solitary confinement for use of profanity and failure to follow the rules. And I just feel like this is the quintessential well-behaved women never make history moment. Uh-huh. Of uh-huh. These women were absolutely like, we are not taking this anymore. And so I love reading their rap sheets and being like, yes, like this just makes you better. So those are the Buffalo 6, as it were, the ones who actually did jail time and endured some really traumatic things in jail to ensure that women could vote. But what's, I think, really important to note is that this is all occurring summer and fall of 1917. So this is at a point in which New York has already accepted women's suffrage. So these are women who now have the right to vote. Yes. And they are out there willing to do jail time because one state is not good enough, right? There are other states in the Union that have already passed women's suffrage, but they are out there and they are absolutely saying, we are going to keep fighting until all women have the right to vote.
That was Lindsay Lauren Visser. And we close out with licensed master social worker Chaney Brockington. She sits with Jay Moran to discuss generational patterns of trauma in Buffalo, along with the systemic barriers to education that results from them.
Let's maybe just a little background, though. You're relatively young. How did you veer toward this field?
That's a great question. Yeah. So I am originally not from here, originally from the Hudson Valley, Catskill Mountain region. Shout out to all my family that is there and might be listening later on, but grew up there in that area and went to school at Le Moyne College in Syracuse and studied psychology. At the time, I was getting a dual degree program. Hmm. So I was studying, getting the bachelor's in psychology, and then I was also doing the dual education program there, and I was planning to be a teacher.
Okay.
And found out very later on in the student teaching development that teaching was not going to be the right field for me. I was doing my first year, foundation year student teaching in Syracuse City School District with some amazing students, some amazing first and second graders who at the time were struggling with just systemic barriers to having the educational classroom and the educational experience that they truly deserved. Not having access to food, not having access to water, having housing insecurity, housing instability, just poverty, right? Systemic and generational poverty.
Right.
And unfortunately, that was really affecting the way that we were interacting in the classroom. They weren't able to focus.
Mm-hmm.
We were oftentimes struggling for snack breaks. Kids were coming with really significant mental health concerns as well at such a young age. And so being a teacher was important, you know, meeting the academic standards for testing that we do have in New York State was important, but I was really struggling to get through it, to be honest with you. It was just very, very difficult. I would stop oftentimes throughout the day just to make sure that they had something to eat, and we just weren't getting through lessons. We have to address those things because it's very difficult for them to have that concentration that we're looking for. And we had kept talking about it, kept brainstorming, and essentially what we acknowledged was this is one of the systemic barriers of our education system.
Right.
We expect our students to all perform at a certain level, but they all don't have all of the basic needs that they need to in order to perform at that level.
So this changed your professional direction.
But 100%.
I wouldn't mind just staying at that moment for just a little bit.
Sure.
Because what you just said, the systemic realities that these young kids, little kids, were facing, you saw them. And now you can see them looking back as somebody who's now, you know, a licensed mental health professional, someone who's dealing with it. Maybe even give us a specific story or stories that you recall of, like you said, we were in a situation, I'm student teaching, I'm trying to get these kids through this lesson, and so-and-so kid shows this because of that. Can you maybe reflect on that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, a couple actually came to mind. I remember we were teaching a math lesson, you know, first, second grade. Students aren't broken up into different classes. It's all at the same time and all in the same classroom. And I was actually teaching a math lesson. And of course, with passing the EdTPA or the assessment for teaching in general, you have to follow these different core components of these classrooms. And so we were teaching a math lesson, and two of my students actually, and I believe that they were half-brother and half-sister, and they both came up in the middle of the math lesson and said, you know, my stomach really hurts. And so I was like, okay, let's, you know, take you to the nurse's station. Let's make sure that you get cleared up. Of course, the nurse brings them back and says, oh, well, you know, they're fine. They probably just don't want to be in math class, whatever the case may be, you know, which, you know, could be a legitimate thing for young kids.
Well, certainly was always my excuse.
Exactly. Sometimes I didn't want to be in math, right? So I'm like, okay. So they bring them back into the classroom. And I believe it was at the end of the math lesson, I'm sitting down with them, and I was trying to show them, you know, here's what it is to do, give them some extra special attention, which is difficult in a room of 21
right.
students. And I was, you know, trying to give them some specialized instruction, and I could hear their stomachs start to growl.
Oh.
And I was like, is that your tummy? And they were like, yeah, it really, really hurts. So they were hungry.
Mm.
And so we identified, when was the last time that you've eaten today? Really started to identify, when was the last time that you actually had a meal? And it was the day before.
Oh, my.
So I believe their last meal was probably leaving the school at the end of the day, having that lunch or that snack at the end of the day that we oftentimes provided in our classroom.
Right.
And so I identified, okay, we got to get some snacks. We need to, you know, address this issue. But they were so distracted and so focused that by the time we got to the whole snack portion, that's it, right? You only have a certain amount of time to get through everything that you need to every day as a teacher. And I know that that example may sound somewhat minimal to someone that's listening, but this is happening on a consistent basis, right? These are two students. We had students every day that were coming in with a different barrier or a different challenge. Oftentimes, students would come in and they would be in tears because of some intimate partner violence that they saw, or CPS being called, or having a parent that in some way was not able to care for them in the way that they deserved. And so having those consistent barriers and watching how it is that students systemically aren't able to accomplish what is needed in their system was just a very riveting thing. And having the privilege of coming from a background of going to predominantly, you know, seminary schools, Catholic preparatory schools, and not seeing those disparities in our educational system until actually moving into college, it was very, very jarring to me. And it made me realize very quickly on that if this is the way that I'm going to have to teach my students, and shout out to all the teachers that do this incredible work on a daily basis, but if this is the way that I'm going to have to teach my students, I don't think I'll be able to continue in this path. I want to make sure that I'm getting to their root causes, their basic needs, so they can have that opportunity to perform in the best way possible.
So you made the switch.
You made the career switch.
So you go from Syracuse, you come to the University of Buffalo to advance your studies,
yes,
of course. But now you get to see Buffalo.
Yeah.
Now, how does the city classrooms in Syracuse, as best you understand, compare to what we see in Buffalo?
Yeah, that was, very shocking. I think that one of the things that I did, and this is going a little bit off topic.
That's fine.
But I was an adjunct faculty over at UB, came back to my alma mater, mm-hmm, and taught there for two semesters, actually. And we taught the Black Lives Matter class, Building Racial Justice and Solidarity. And one of the activities that I had my students do was an activity was called City of Good Neighbors. And the reason why is because obviously that is a very big slogan and umbrella for Buffalo, is this idea of City of Good Neighbors, and the kind of the cornerstone of like a Buffalo slogan, if you will.
It's definitely a slogan.
It's definitely a slogan for sure, right? And so one of the things that we had them do in this activity that we would do every week was to address a different experience or a different news article or some research on Buffalo as a whole, and some of the disparities that we're seeing as it relates to race. Because the idea is that if it's a city of good neighbors, it should be a city of good neighbors for everybody, right? Everybody should have equal opportunity. Everybody should be feeling as if they are receiving, you know, good neighborship, if you will.
Sure.
And so what my students very quickly found is that it has not been. And that is the same exact thing that I found as it relates to going into our school districts, our school systems, but also just our criminal justice system, right? Our current layout of land, our history of segregation. And being someone who is a non-Buffalo native, I know it can be very jarring to hear someone that's not from the area say, oh, well, I'm going to do all this research. But I think it's important. I think it's important when you go into a new city and you move in to know the lay of the land, to know the history, to know how it is that it's affected the people and the residents that call Buffalo home. And so we found similar disparities, but unfortunately more in our school systems. Our school system here in Buffalo is on track to be very, very close to what we're seeing in New York City. We have out-of-school suspension rates that are very similar to New York City and to other larger cities, and we don't nearly have the concentration per capita. But yet those statistics are very similar, if not higher, here in Buffalo. We also have 4 out of 5 students in Buffalo qualifying for free or reduced lunch at this time. And that study was post 2020,
okay,
but still a couple of years ago.
Right.
And so the number is growing exponentially. It's projected to be at about 4.5 out of Buffalo City residents and students being qualifying for free or reduced lunch.
So if 4 out of 5 students are qualifying for free lunches at school or reduced lunches at school, it's safe to assume that there are several who are struggling with food on a regular basis. Going back to your earlier story of the 7 and 8 year olds who couldn't stay in class because their stomachs were hurting because they were starving.
Absolutely. A lot of our students, and I've heard this from incredible individuals that do a lot of the food trust here, such as the African Heritage Food Co-op, such as the amazing talks and conversations, such as the Buffalo Black Caucus Caucus that's hosted by Zanetta Everhart, and so many other different conversations and community forums and community rallies for change and advocacy that oftentimes our students, their last meal that they're having is either at the school district or at home, but there is a level of food insecurity that sometimes can still be present at the home. If you have students that are qualifying for free or reduced lunch, it's not anything of their doing, and oftentimes it's not anything of their parents doing. It's systematically related, but at the same time, we know that that means that those students' income for the household is at or below poverty level.
I don't want to necessarily get too general, but if we can see that there are these many students struggling with basic issue like hunger, what's the likelihood that we're going to see those kids fall into that next level, that student suspension level that often we hear about the classroom to prison pipelines or school to prison pipeline? What about that? Can you take us through that a little bit and those associations?
Absolutely. There is a huge intersectionality there. Maslow's hierarchy of needs, mm-hmm. right? If anyone's ever seen it, it's that big triangle. It's right. Got those different levels. There are two basic needs that every human needs to have in order to meet those additional levels of, you know, self-actualization, of trust, of realization, of learning, of like this higher calling. And those basic levels are safety and security. Safety includes not just, you know, psychological safety, but also physiological safety. So having your basic needs met, such as housing, food, shelter, clothing, water, all of those basic things. If you're not able to have those basic things, you are then going to really struggle, if not be able to obtain that next level of self-actualization, of being able to understand educational values, to be able to develop your own core values and your own core belief systems, which are going to then allow you to become that next stage, or as we call it in American terms, productive member, quote unquote, of society.
There's all sorts of meaning inside that, but I'll
absolutely, right? There's so much meaning.
Right.
But I say all that to say that when we have students that do not have their basic needs met, and when we have a city where those basic needs have not been met for a while, and there are individuals, trained, educationed individuals in that city that understand the generational patterns, that understand the generational traumas that have happened, and are watching their communities not receive the same resources as other communities. Not only are there emotions that come from that, but there are just physiological changes that take place. So when you bring a student and they don't have their basic needs met, the likelihood of them being able to sit in a desk, which for most adults is difficult throughout
Certainly.
The day, right? You
Absolutely.
Know, we talk about going to the water jug that used to be the right. the pre-COVID joke, right?
Right?
Going
right.
to the water jug or going yeah. to take a smoke break or right. a regular break or a non-smoker's break, right? It's very difficult to sit in a seat for 8 hours and continue your job. For a child that's still growing, that is an extremely difficult task to just be done, regardless of whether you're in a traditional or non-traditional classroom setting. So when we then expect students that have not had the proper adequate care, have maybe possibly dealt with possible violence at home or just not adaptive home life situations, have dealt with housing insecurity, right? Not just food, but just housing insecurity. Haven't had a safe bed to sleep in at night. Maybe haven't had a bed to sleep in at night. Had to sleep on somebody's couch because there's something going on in the household. Economic insecurity. Don't have the proper shoes to wear. Don't have the proper gear to wear because they're going to have to walk because we don't have a busing system in the way that other school districts and other cities do.
Right.
All those basic barriers, the likelihood of them being able to get in the classroom, sit for 8 hours, not cause any what we're calling disruption, and be prepared for class is staggering. And then when you look at what our students are being suspended for, right, it's not what we fantasize and what we unfortunately fearmonger people to believe. It's not, you know, a student is fighting or stabbing, which we have seen, and I'm not denying that.
Sure.
But it's oftentimes they were out of dress code, right? they responded to a teacher in a way that they didn't feel was appropriate. They used language that is sometimes either used at home or that they've heard friends utilize, or language that just is not traditionally appropriate for a classroom setting. They've talked back to a student. When you're looking at those infractions and what the infractions are for, their hair was not in the appropriate way. And then you're sending them back home into a system where they're already not then going to have their needs met. There's a staggering chance that not only, A, they're going to re-likely be suspended again, because all it takes is one time, and okay. Those statistics have been shown.
That's you're saying that there's no doubt about that?
Absolutely, okay. Right. There's a, I believe it's...
So it's not if I suspend you for a month, you're going to learn your lesson.
Exactly.
Okay.
It's not if I suspend you for a month, you're going to learn your lesson.
You're
going to
change, you're going to be this...
Exactly, that you're going to come back rehabilitated is the idea. It's, we're going to come back, and more than likely, I'm going to do this again, right? And it's going to continue to happen again. And there is an implicit bias that goes into a teacher looking and seeing a name now that they have now suspended or that has been involved in the start or the root of the justice system before, and then reentering that again. But the likelihood of then having some type of criminal legal interaction, police interaction, school police officer, school resource officer interaction, then increases. And once that happens, you just have that perfect trajectory into the school to prison pipeline. The data has shown that it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when.
Really?
And that's the really scary part about it, for sure, and troubling part
and
about
almost
it.
Inevitable.
Almost inevitable. I believe the statistics were, it's 1 in 3 as the justice system relates over the age of 18. It's 1 or 3 males of color will have an interaction with the justice system before the age of 50 years old. We know that that oftentimes starts at an earlier age, average between the ages of 18 and 23. But when we look at the statistics and we include out-of-school suspension rates, that number jumps. I believe that it is somewhere around like 64% of individuals that have had an out-of-school suspension are likely to have another suspension. But especially when we look at Black and brown youth, we see that there's 84% of all of the youth that are suspended in our public school system are African American. And so even those numbers speak to a larger issue there.
You are a member of the board member of the Erie County Restorative Justice Coalition.
Yes.
Restorative Justice.
Mm-hmm.
To you, what is restorative justice?
Yeah. Oh, restorative justice. That is a tough word. And if you ask 15 different people,
sure.
I promise you'll get 35 different answers.
Okay.
I've talked about this a couple of times. And restorative justice to me is really this idea of not just repairing harm, but it's also transforming the way in which we look at harm. When we look at offense as a whole in this country, but even on a smaller scale here in Erie County, we are very quick to not just penalize, but also prosecute the individual that has caused the harm, and not look at why it is that the harm was caused and how it is that we can properly do justice for the individual that was harmed. Restorative justice looks to kind of transform that model.
Okay.
And in some ways, it's been looked at as a very radical model, but it actually has very, I could say radical results, right? We've seen that the effects of restorative justice being practiced in schools and outside of schools with young adults has been life-changing. Restorative justice really looks to identify what was the harm that was caused to someone at any given time, or to a system, or to a population of individuals. How did that harm impact that person? What were some of the factors that may have influenced the harm happening in the first place, and kind of a what's next question,
okay,
right? Where do we go from here?
Sure.
How is it that we can make sure that both parties are able to understand why it is that the harm happened, and what it is to make sure, or what it is that we can do to make sure that that harm does not happen again, that the population and that the community served becomes better as a result of that, and that the community and the population served feel safer as a result.
Okay.
We are living in very, very heightened times. It's the nicest way that I can say it, right? We know that, unfortunately, there will be harm, right? There will be an incident at a school or something that happens in a neighborhood. We're aware of that, right? Our system tells us that. The lay of the land tells us that. Our map of Buffalo's history, unfortunately, tells us that as well. So it's looking at a proactive approach. How is it that we can get involved before there is harm to make sure that there are systems in place that provide space for others to understand the impact of their harm and in the impacts of harms on their community?
What might be an example of like you said, a proactive approach to that?
Well, I think just even the work that the Restorative Justice Coalition is doing, and that all goes to Dina Thompson and her amazing team and staff over at the Restorative Justice Coalition, getting involved in different school districts. They are involved in many school districts already in the Western New York area and have been doing incredible work to make sure that they are located in the school, that they are doing forums in the school, so that the schools are aware of who it is that they can call before something happens,
right?
If they have the education beforehand, the likelihood of being able to pick up the phone and saying, hey, I have this resource increases.
Okay.
Let's say a student, let's go with taking, which I know has happened, right? Take somebody's phone.
Okay.
Right? They steal a phone in the school district, right? The school's response is immediately, right, to get involved, call school truancy officer, school resource officer, get them involved, suspend the student. Student's out of school for a month or is indefinitely suspended. Now they have to go to another school, reintegrate. The likelihood of them doing just as well at that school or better at that school than they were at the other school, we know, is not even on an equal margin scale. And then the system just starts and it just jets up. In the restorative justice model, right, it's not saying, well, that student doesn't have any penalty. The Restorative Justice Coalition would come together and kind of create a group setting where all the stakeholders are involved. So you might have the teacher that was there the day that the phone was stolen or in the classroom where the phone was stolen. You'd have the student who stole the phone, you'd have the child that's whose phone was stolen, you would have maybe their parents, maybe a pastor or a spiritual leader that is related to or, you know, in close proximity to the student who has had their phone stolen from them. And you'd have all these individuals kind of sitting together in a round table to be able to identify what happened here, what exactly took place. Here's the evidence that we have. How is it that the individual who has been harmed is feeling, right? Or as most people would consider the victim,
right?
How is it that the victim or the person that's been harmed is feeling, and give them space to be able to share how it is that this affected them? Well, my mom bought me this phone. You know, I just got this phone for my birthday. It was really expensive. I felt violated, whatever the case may be. When you have a traditional setting where a student is harmed or a person is harmed in some way, oftentimes there isn't that space. There isn't that space for the person who's harmed to say, this is exactly what it is that you did. I want to know this, 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 and this. I want to know why. Even in our court system, when we do have victims that are making an impact statement, they're not getting, it's not a call and response,
right?
They're usually sitting with the defense and, you know, reading their statement directly to the court system, which, yes, of course, that gives an outlet. It gives space. We deserve to be able to have every voice amplified and every voice heard.
And that will do it for Producer's Picks. We thank our guests, Lindsay Lauren Visser and Chaney Brockington. If you missed anything or would like to hear it again, you can get this program as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Each episode is online at WBFO.org. I'm Thomas O'Neill White. Thanks for listening.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.